Thank you very much for inviting me, and thank you all for coming and wanting to spend some time listening to me. It's a great honor to be here, and I would like to especially thank UCD School of Politics and International Relations for organizing this this event. Sexual violence in conflict is, I'm often told, unavoidable. That it should be considered collateral damage. That the phenomenon is nothing new. And the latter is certainly true. Already Homer, actually, in the Iliad, has described how Trojan women were treated as war prizes, the most famous of whom is Briseis, princess of Lyrnessus, who was given to Achilles for having led the assault on the city during the Trojan War. Also in the Bible, you can find references to virgins as prizes of war. Moses said, "Have you let all the women live? Now, therefore, kill every male among the little ones and kill every woman who has known man by lying with him. But all the young girls who have not known man by lying with him, keep alive for yourselves." So women were, virgins were identified as war prizes. In more recent history, we have numerous examples of rape and sexual violence from the 30 Years' War, from the US Civil War, from colonial wars in Africa, the Central European counter-revolution in the 20s, from the Second World War, both in Asia, Russia, and Europe, including the post-conflict situations in the countries affected. And from our days, we have horrific stories of rape on an unprecedented scale in the Western Balkans, as you remember, in our own part of the world, Rwanda, Timor-Leste, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. And the pictures you will see are from my recent visit to the DRC. All of this can certainly make rape and sexual violence seem unavoidable, as if it was something that we would have to accept as part of or consequence of any conflict. But I think we cannot and should not accept these false premises and empty assertions, because sexual violence in conflict is neither cultural nor sexual, actually. It's criminal. And no other human rights violation is routinely dismissed as inevitable. I would like to say something about the changing nature of armed conflicts and wars. And I would say that the nature of war has changed dramatically in recent years, because traditionally, you think of war as being a fight over territory, land or territory, by two well-equipped and well-disciplined armies on the battlefield. But instead, modern warfare is predominantly intrastate or domestic, often in failed states, waged by non-state actors and triggered by issues of identity, ethnicity, religion, and competition for land or resources, particularly oil and mineral resources. And in the DRC, for example, control of the country's minerals have fueled the country's conflicts by enriching armed groups, helping them to buy weapons and carry on with their activities. And they have employed sexual violence as a tactic of war. One such mineral, coltan, is so widely used in mobile phones, it's in all your mobile phones, that somebody says that we all carry a piece of the Congo in our pockets. And this is where most of coltan is found. It's in the DRC. The changing nature of armed conflict, if this is the modern nature of war and conflict, it also means that there has been a transformation in terms of who is mostly affected by hostilities. During the Russo-Japanese War of 1904-1905, for example, civilian casualties were almost non-existent, while today we know that more than 70% of those killed or wounded in wars are non-combatants. So in contemporary low-intensity wars, rebel groups and government forces often kill civilians and defy international law. And it has been said that most civilians tend to die from war rather than in battle. And women have ended up on the front line, not as soldiers, but as victims. And from this follows also that the role of you and the United Nations peacekeepers and our missions is also changing. What does it mean to be a peacekeeper today? Well, very often, like in the DRC, that the role in seven of the peacekeeping missions we have today, there is a particular role in protecting civilians. So it is in the mandate you have to protect civilians. And then you have to think of who are civilians. Well, you cannot do it in a gender-blind way. You have to ask, what are the needs of women? What do they need in terms of protection? And it's not exactly the same as protecting men. So you have to be much more, you have to be better trained to be able to protect civilians. So the changing nature of war, meaning more civilians as victims, meaning also that the role of the UN is changing. And I think we are right at the core of this very dramatic change in how we understand modern wars and conflicts. For each rape reported, it is likely that 10 to 20 go unreported. Sexual violence in conflict has become the weapon of choice. And the reason is as simple as it is wicked, because it's cheap, silent, and effective. One does not need bullets or bombs, only individuals with cruel intent. And acts of sexual violence do not only maim its victims mentally and physically, but they sow the seeds of destruction of an entire community. Female survivors in some instances become pregnant, often get infected with sexually transmitted diseases, including HIV/AIDS, can develop incontinence, and are regularly rejected by their own families, shunned by their men, and very often forced to live marginalized. And traditionally, the risks for the architects behind the atrocities have been negligible. While the women walk in shame, the perpetrators walk free. Maybe I'll use some water. I was just talking about the quality of Irish water, but you don't need to drink bottled water. As former Environment Commissioner, I would advocate drink tap water. The challenges to overcome on an individual level, the physical and psychological trauma of rape and other forms of sexual violence in conflict should not be underestimated. Because in addition to these long-term psychological injuries that may include depression, anxiety disorders, flashbacks, difficulties, of course, in reestablishing intimate relationships and fear. Sexual violence is also an obstacle to sustainable peace for several reasons. Because long-term sexual violence undermines social safety through the destruction of families and societies. And I just mentioned earlier today that those young men that in Liberia or Sierra Leone during the war there were so many child soldiers there, and they were forced not only to sometimes rape their sisters or their mothers in front of the family and the whole village, but also to chop off arms or legs and this was used, the maiming was used as a method. Of course, today are expected to live in a peaceful society and create a life for themselves without any psychosocial counseling or help. And of course, this has also destroyed everything that you can call family norms or values and understanding of what is right and what is wrong. The fear of assaults is also an impediment to women's participation in economic activities and girls' school attendance. And if impunity reigns, then the faith in a country's judicial system and its ability to protect its citizens is seriously undermined. So this is such a heavy impediment to try to build anything that can be called a sustainable peace or a situation with security in a country. Women must be active participants during the peace process and its aftermath and must take an equal role in shaping these decisions. And lack of a reconciliation process which includes women might jeopardize the long-term stability of a society after the conflict is over. No peace agreement engineered solely by men will ever be legitimate as long as wars affect the lives and livelihoods of women. And as I've said, this is what it does. And Patrick Kammert, our general working actually with us in our office now, he says that today it can be more dangerous to be a woman than to be a soldier in many of the modern wars. And no society emerging from the ashes of conflict can realize its full potential unless women and girls are free to realize theirs. And unfortunately, this far from often happens. For many in positions of power, women are only seen as victims rather than as agents for change. And despite women's engagement in informal efforts to build peace, they are often excluded from any formal peace-building efforts. And this was also the case in a country like Liberia, for example. The women traveled at their own expense to where the peace negotiations were held. And they demonstrated outside the building in a nice hotel, and these armed groups and former rebels, of course, loved it to be there. They had no interest in coming quickly to an agreement. But the women sort of blocked the doors and windows and said, we'll sit here until you actually sign. We want peace. And in the end, this was a kind of paradox. In the end, they said, we threatened to undress. And it's a shame, you know, the tradition is that it's a shame to see your mother naked without any clothes. So it was actually a threat to these men in the end. It worked as a threat that they would stay there. They refused to go anywhere, and they would block the doors and windows until the peace agreement was signed. And they made a difference. And they also warned against the demobilization process afterwards. They said you cannot invite all men to come with their weapon and hand them over to the UN. You know what will happen. They will come drunk, they will start to fight, and with all those weapons circulating, you have prepared for a catastrophe. And this was exactly what happened. The UN and others refused to listen to the women. And they were not seen as a party to the negotiations, to the peace negotiations, so they were not at the table formally. In Somalia, they had to form a sixth clan, because the five clans that did negotiate in those days were all men. So women had to form their own clan to even be at the table. But how can you shape a peace or a peace process and exclude half the population? In some cases, a majority of the population. As an item on the global policymaking agenda, sexual violence in conflict has traditionally been absent, despite its horrible and very real existence on the ground. The UN Security Council, which bears the primary responsibility for maintaining international peace and security, as you know, this year, because it's the 10th anniversary, they established Resolution 1325. And this was the first resolution to recognize that war impacts women and men differently, and mandated the United Nations itself and its member states to protect individuals from sexual violence in conflict. But it would take almost another decade until the specific issue of sexual violence in conflict became the subject of its own resolution. That was Resolution 1820, which recognized sexual violence as a tactic of war. And it confirms that this is a matter of international peace and security, and therefore within the remit of the Security Council. And that resolution demands nothing less than the immediate and complete cessation of by all parties to armed conflict of all acts of sexual violence against civilians. And it was a historic response to this horrific reality. And Resolution 1888, finally, from last year, established the position that I'm the first to hold, that is to act as an advocate, coordinator, and leader within the UN system to address this issue. And it also requested the United Nations action against sexual violence in conflict, which is a network of 13 UN entities, including UNICEF, UNIFEM, all the ones that you know, to assist me as a special representative in this task. Legally speaking, the notion that sexual violence in conflict is a crime against international law has emerged only very recently and has been established first and foremost through jurisprudence emanating from the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda and also the Tribunal for Former Yugoslavia. And a strictly legal definition of rape and other forms of sexual violence continues to develop. Under the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, ICC, rape, sexual slavery, enforced prostitution, forced pregnancy, enforced sterilization, and any other form of sexual violence of comparable gravity are recognized both as crimes against humanity and as war crimes. So it's actually different types of violations that are recognized as sexual violence. It's not only rape. As you can see from these pictures, I recently returned from a second visit to the DRC, and the eastern part of the DRC has been called, and it was not me that coined the phrase, but it has been called the rape capital of the world for a reason. Over 200,000 rapes have been reported since the war started more than a decade ago, and only a few months ago, more than 300 rapes were reported to have taken place in Valikali in North Kivu. And a 70-year-old woman who shared her story told me that she had tried in vain to convince the rapists to leave her alone, pointing out to them that they could be her own grandchildren. Of course, the United Nations is often criticized for our shortcomings and mistakes. And the Valikali incidents were no different. And this has also been acknowledged and debated in the Security Council. And rather than trying to present any excuses, we need to look at the explanations. Why is it that the UN could not interpret the early warning signals? Why is it that we could not respond effectively or prevent these rapes from happening? And how we can improve. And I also think that it's important to look at what are we doing well and how these actions can be further strengthened. And in response to the changing dynamics of conflict that I mentioned at the beginning, and in light of these lessons learned, we have to be better at protecting civilians, especially women and also children. And the UN's peacekeeping troops have gathered best practices how to do this in an inventory of best peacekeeping practices. And that was developed by this UN Action, the umbrella organization, and I helped to launch that earlier this year. And what it says is, for example, the value of having community liaison officers who can build a relationship of trust with the community, including we with women. to deploy foot patrols that can actively engage with the population and that are more accessible and approachable. And of course, ensure that peacekeepers on these patrols know how to recognize and react to reports of sexual violence. And that means, for example, in Valikale, when they saw that these rebel groups were on the move, when they started to block off roads, when they were starting to loot and pillage these small, there were a number of 15 villages along the road, then you can assume rape. You have to establish early warning and distress call systems, even though it's difficult because would they know that somebody has a mobile phone or anything, they of course would attack that person. So you have to be very careful in how you deploy these kind of devices as well. You have to signal night presence. Sometimes it's enough to have big spotlights lit or to make sure that you actually patrol an area, also nighttime, and use joint patrols, which include peacekeepers, but also engages local NGOs and others from the village. And of course, demonstrate that the primary responsibility rests with the national and regional authorities. States bear primary responsibility for protecting their civilians from violence. And I see my role as helping to build the capacity of governments to meet their obligations. Because the UN and no number of peacekeepers can ever substitute a state. We cannot supplant a state. And capacity building means improving data collection, statistics, monitoring, evaluation, and better reporting mechanisms. And then the data must be widely publicized to educate communities. And I think that having the right monitoring and reporting also in turn makes it safer and easier for women to report these crimes. So the paradox is that if the number of reported rapes go up, it could also be a sign of success, that actually women trust that it is worth it to report these rapes, to actually go to a health service or to go to the police and report these crimes. In some countries, building capacity can have a comprehensive reach and include actually overhauling the entire judicial system, and that is no small challenge. I have used examples from Africa only because thus far my missions have been to Liberia and to the DRC. And it is not a specifically African problem, but one that unfortunately exists in many parts of the world. And I've said to the Security Council that I would like to focus my work on 5 to 7 countries during my mandate, and I will stay as close as possible to the agenda of the Security Council to make my work relevant to what they are discussing and the peacekeeping operations that we have around the world. And right now we are discussing, should we also include countries like Colombia, Timor-Leste? We know that this is a problem in Burma and it's used there. I will next week visit Bosnia-Herzegovina, and that is also again to talk to victims and hear what happened, what happens today, what are the lessons learned. And hopefully also find something positive in all of this, that is where there is no proof that sexual violence has been used in a systematic, widespread and well-planned manner. Some say that Sri Lanka is an example of that, and again, remember that rape happens everywhere. I think in the US there are 200,000 rapes every year. Violence against women you will find everywhere, but here we are dealing with this as a phenomenon, as a consequence or a tactic of war or conflict, and that is how we will also focus our efforts. But where we cannot find it as a part of a, where it is not a systematic pattern, that is also interesting to see. Why is that? How is the whole chain of command working? How can we instead spread that kind of knowledge? I also believe that we have to impose tougher terms when providing assistance to countries. Donors and different parts of the UN system must be much better coordinated. And we have seen examples in the DRC where I met with a team that works on sexual violence and rape, a great team in Goma, and they are 39 police, local police, and they were fantastic. They were sitting in something that we would probably keep our hens in or the chicken in, but with no electricity, but with a computer donated by somebody. But they couldn't use it because they didn't have any electricity, and they had one vehicle. So they actually had to ask the perpetrator to sit up behind them to go to the police station. And I don't think that's very effective. So maybe instead of offering many training courses, somebody could buy them another vehicle, which they would need most of all. So if donors coordinated better their help and assistance, it could work better on the ground. The issue of women's participation in efforts to prevent and address sexual violence as a threat to their security and as an impediment to peace, it still has a very long way to go. Some achievements have been made in the last decades. I think the Beijing Platform for Action, to which 189 countries are signatories and adopted in 95, they agreed and the participation of women in national reconciliation and reconstruction efforts, and also to investigate and punish those who perpetuate violence against women in armed conflict. One of the few glimpses of light and hope during this last visit was also that we apprehended Lieutenant Colonel Mayele, one of the rebel commanders of the armed groups, presumed to be responsible for these mass rapes. And this was followed only a few days later by the announcement by ICC of the arrest of Calixma Burashimana, who is the executive secretary of the FDLR, working from Paris. And he was one of the first to issue a press release saying, no, we are innocent, we are not involved in these rapes. Why is it important? Well, it's crucial because it sends a strong message to these and other perpetrators that acts of sexual violence in conflict, that we are aware of the atrocities they commit and that justice will ultimately prevail. And that goes back to the goals that I've set for my mandate, because my first point is end impunity, ensuring that perpetrators do not remain at the helm of security institutions and that amnesty is not an option. Close all exits, close all career possibilities for rapists. If women continue to suffer sexual violence, it is not because the law is inadequate to protect them, but because it's inadequately enforced. Secondly, women must be given a voice, power and influence. A ceasefire is not synonymous with peace for women if the shooting stops but rapes continue unchecked. And the third point is to mobilize political leadership. Resolutions are tools in the hands of political leaders and should be used as such. And one of the issues I will raise with the government here in Ireland today or tomorrow is the illegal exploitation of these conflict minerals, because I think that Europe should follow the example of the United States. In their financial reform package, they adopted measures saying that they first of all should do a mapping of these conflict minerals, but also saying that importers of conflict minerals should know where they have to declare where these minerals come from. And in an annex, these types of minerals are listed. And we have to make sure that they cannot, these conflict minerals cannot fuel the conflict, and that this is used to finance also the activities by the groups. My fourth point is to increase our knowledge and recognition of rape as a tactic and consequence of the conflict. And I think the Council, the Security Council, should be ready and willing to use all the tools they have in their toolbox, including sanctions, listing, naming and shaming, visa ban, freeze of assets of these leaders, and be ready to use all these tools. And finally, to make sure that I can drive a better coordination of the entire UN system. I think that we can do much better. So finally, women have no rights if those who violate their rights go unpunished. And I am still, and I said this in the Security Council as well, I'm still haunted by what I heard in the DRC. Women are still not safe under their own roofs, in their own beds when night falls. And our aim must be to uphold international law so that women, even in the war-torn corners of our world, can sleep safe and sound. And far from being a niche issue, far from being looked at as the lowest on a false hierarchy of war horrors, sexual violence is a heavy impediment to peace, and it's part of a larger pattern. Rule by sexual violence is used by political and military leaders to achieve political, military, and economic ends. And these crimes present a security crisis that demands a security response. And to me, this inventory of best peacekeeping practices is the start, not an end, of a process to identify what works in preventing sexual violence and improving women's security. So much more must yet be done to promote actions that have real impact, so we move from recognition to action, from best intentions to best practice. And that journey has only begun. Thank you for listening so long to me. Thank you.